This is a Vision Australia Radio podcast.
Welcome to Cover to Cover from Vision Australia Radio. I'm Tim McQueen. In this edition, Anne Brett joins us with Clean Sweep Ignatius by Jeffrey Archer, and I reread The Americans by Barry Lee Thompson with a new introduction.
Clean Sweep Ignatius, a short story by Jeffrey Archer from a book on the title of Twisting the Tale, published in 1988. Few showed much interest when Ignatius Agabi was appointed Nigeria's Minister of Finance. After all, the cynics pointed out, he was the 17th person to hold the office in 17 years. In Ignatius's first major policy statement to Parliament, he promised to end graft and corruption in public life and warned the electorate that no one holding an official position could feel safe unless he led a blameless life. He ended his maiden speech with the words, "I intend to clear out Nigeria's Augean stables." Such was the impact of the minister's speech that it failed to get a mention in the Lagos Daily Times. Perhaps the editor considered that, since the paper had covered the speeches of the previous 16 ministers in extenso, his readers might feel they had heard it all before. Ignatius, however, was not to be disheartened by the lack of confidence shown in him, and set about his new task with vigour and determination. Within days of his appointment, he'd caused a minor official at the Ministry of Trade to be jailed for falsifying documents relating to the import of grain. The next to feel the bristles of Ignatius's new broom was a leading Lebanese financier who was deported without trial for breach of the exchange control regulations. A month later came an event which even Ignatius considered a personal coup: the arrest of Inspector General of Police for accepting bribes, a perk the citizens of Lagos had in the past considered went with the job. When 4 months later the police chief was sentenced to 18 months in jail, the new finance minister finally made the front page of the Lagos Daily Times. A leader on the centre page dubbed him "Clean Sweep Ignatius, the new broom every guilty man feared." Ignatius's reputation as Mr. Clean continued to grow as arrest followed arrest and unfounded rumours began circulating in the capital that even General Otobi, the head of state, was under investigation by his own finance minister. Ignatius alone now checked, vetted and authorised all foreign contracts worth over $100 million. And although every decision he made was meticulously scrutinised by his enemies, not a breath of scandal ever became associated with his name. When Ignatius began his second year of office as Minister of Finance, even the cynics began to acknowledge his achievements. It was about this time that General Otobi felt confident enough to call Ignatius in for an unscheduled consultation. The head of state welcomed the minister to Dodan Barracks and ushered him to a comfortable chair in his study, overlooking the parade ground. "Ignatius, I've just finished going over the latest budget report. I am alarmed by your conclusion that the Exchequer's still losing millions of dollars each year in bribes paid to go-betweens by foreign companies. Have you any idea into whose pockets this money is falling? That's what I want to know." Ignatius sat bolt upright, his eyes never leaving the head of state. "I suspect a great percentage of the money is ending up in private Swiss bank accounts, but I am at present unable to prove it." "Then I will give you whatever authority you require to do so," said General Otobi. "You can use any means you consider necessary to ferret out these villains. Start by investigating every member of my cabinet, past and present, and show no fear or favour in your endeavours, no matter what their rank or connections. For such a task to have any chance of success, I would need a special letter of authority signed by you, General. It will be on your desk by 6 o'clock this evening," said the head of state, "and the rank of ambassador plenipotentiary whenever I travel aboard." "Granted." "Thank you," said Ignatius, rising from his chair on the assumption that the audience was over. "You may also need this," said the general as they walked towards the door. The head of state handed Ignatius a small automatic pistol. "Because I suspect by now you have almost as many enemies as I do." Ignatius took the pistol from his shoulder awkwardly, put it in his pocket and rumbled his thanks. Without another word passing between the two men, Ignatius left his leader and was driven back to his ministry. Without the knowledge of the governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria and unhindered by any senior civil servants, Ignatius enthusiastically set about his new task. He researched alone at night and by day discussed his findings with no one. 3 months later, he was ready to pounce. The minister selected the month of August to make an unscheduled visit abroad, as it was a time when most Nigerians went on holiday, and his absence would therefore not be worthy of comment. He asked his permanent secretary to book him, his wife, and their 2 children on a flight to Orlando, and to be certain that the tickets were charged to his personal account. On their arrival in Florida, the family checked into the local Marriott Hotel. Ignatius then informed his wife, without warning or explanation, that he would be spending a few days in New York on business before returning to them for the rest of the holiday. The following morning, he left his family to the mysteries of Disney World while he took a flight to New York. It was a short taxi ride from LaGuardia to Kennedy, where after a change of clothes and the purchase of a return tourist ticket for cash, he boarded a Swissair flight for Geneva, unobserved. Once he arrived, Ignatius booked into an inconspicuous hotel, retired to bed and slept soundly for 8 hours. Over breakfast the following morning, he studied the list of banks he had so carefully drawn up after completing his research in Nigeria. Each name was written out boldly in his own hand. Ignatius decided to start with Gerber & Co., whose building he observed from the hotel bedroom took up half the Avenue de Parchin. He checked the telephone number with the concierge before placing a call. The chairman agreed to see him at 12 o'clock. Carrying only a battered briefcase, Ignatius arrived at the bank a few minutes before the appointed hour, an unusual occurrence for a Nigerian, thought the young man, dressed in a smart grey suit, white shirt and grey silk tie. He was waiting in the marble hall to greet him. He bowed to the minister, introducing himself as the chairman's personal assistant, and explained that he would accompany Ignatius to the chairman's office. The young executive led the minister to a waiting lift, and neither man uttered another word until they had reached the 11th floor. A gentle tap on the chairman's door elicited "Entrez," which the young man obeyed. "Nigerian Minister of Finance, sir." The chairman rose from behind his desk and stepped forward to greet his guest. Ignatius could not help noticing that he, too, wore a grey suit, white shirt, and a grey silk tie. "Good morning, Minister," the chairman said. "Won't you have a seat?" He ushered Ignatius towards a low glass table surrounded by comfortable chairs on the far side of the room. "I have ordered coffee for both of us, if that is acceptable." Ignatius nodded, placed a battered briefcase on the floor by the side of his chair, and stared out of the large plate glass window. He made some small talk about the splendid view of the magnificent fountain, while a girl served all 3 men with coffee. Once the young woman had left the room, Ignatius got down to business. "My head of state has requested that I visit your bank with a rather unusual request," he began. Not a flicker of surprise appeared on the face of the chairman or his young assistant. "He has honoured me with the task of discovering which Nigerian citizens hold numbered accounts with your bank." On learning this piece of information, only the chairman's lips moved. "I am not at liberty to disclose. Allow me to put my case," said the minister, raising a white palm. "First, let me assure you that I come with the absolute authority of my government." Without another word, Ignatius extracted an envelope from his inside pocket with a flourish. He handed it to the chairman, who removed the letter inside and read it slowly. Once he finished reading, the banker cleared his throat. "This document, I fear, sir, carries no validity in my country." He replaced it in the envelope and handed it back to Ignatius. "I am, of course," continued the chairman, "not for 1 moment doubting that you have the full backing of your head of state, both as a minister and an ambassador. But that does not change the bank's rule of confidentiality in such matters. There are no circumstances in which we would release the names of any of our account holders without their authority. I'm sorry to be of so little help, but those are and will always remain the bank rules. The chairman rose to his feet as he considered the meeting was now at an end, but he'd not bargained to clean sweep Ignatius. My head of state, said Ignatius, softening his tone, has authorised me to approach your bank to act as the intermediary for all future transactions between our country and Switzerland. We're flattered by your confidence, Minister, replied the chairman. He remained standing. However, I feel sure that you will understand that it cannot alter our attitude to our customers' confidentiality. Ignatius remained unperturbed. Then I'm sorry to inform you, Mr. Gerber, that our ambassador in Geneva will be instructed to make an official communique to the Swiss Foreign Office about the lack of cooperation your bank has shown concerning your request for information about our nationals. He waited for his words to sink in. You could avoid such embarrassment, of course, by simply letting me know the names of my countrymen who hold accounts with the Gerber & Co. and the amounts involved. I can assure you we would not reveal the source of our information. You're most welcome to lodge such a communique, sir, and I feel sure that our minister will explain to your ambassador in the most courteous of diplomatic language that the Foreign Ministry does not have the authority under Swiss law to demand such disclosures. If that is the case, I shall instruct my own Ministry of Trade to halt all future dealings in Nigeria with any Swiss nationals until those names are revealed. That is your privilege, Minister, replied the chairman, unmoved. And we may also have to reconsider every contract currently being negotiated by your countrymen in Nigeria. And in addition, I shall personally see to it that no penalty clauses are honoured. Would you not consider such action a little precipitate? Let me assure you, Mr. Gerber, that I would not lose one moment of sleep over such a decision, said Ignatius. Even if my efforts to discover these names were to bring your country to its knees, I would not be moved. So be it, Minister, replied the chairman. However, it still does not alter the policy or the attitude of this bank to confidentiality. If that remains the case, sir, this very day I shall give instructions to our ambassador to close our embassy in Geneva, and I shall declare your ambassador in Lagos persona non grata. For the first time, the chairman raised his eyebrows. Furthermore, continued Ignatius, I will hold a conference in London, which will leave the world's press in no doubt of my head of state's displeasure with the conduct of this bank. After such publicity, I feel confident you will find that many of your customers prefer to close their accounts, while others who have in the past considered you a safe haven may find it necessary to look elsewhere. The minister waited, but still the chairman did not respond. Then you leave me no choice, said Ignatius, rising from his seat. The chairman stretched out his arm, assuming that at last the minister was leaving, only to watch with horror as Ignatius placed a hand in his pocket and removed a small pistol. The two Swiss bankers froze as the Nigerian Minister of Finance stepped forward and pressed a muzzle against the chairman's temple. I need those names, Mr. Gerber, and by now you must realise I will stop at nothing. If you don't supply them immediately, I'm going to blow your brains out. Do you understand? The chairman gave a slight nod, beads of sweat appearing on his forehead. And he will be next, said Ignatius, gesturing towards a young assistant, who stood speechless and paralysed, a few paces away. Get me the names of every Nigerian who holds an account in this bank, Ignatius said quietly, looking towards the young man, or I'll blow your chairman's brains all over this soft pile carpet. Immediately, do you hear me? He added sharply. The young man looked towards the chairman, who was now trembling, but said quite clearly, Non, Pierre, never. All right, replied the assistant in a whisper. You can't say I didn't give you every chance, Ignatius pulled back the hammer. The sweat was now pouring down the chairman's face, and the young man had to turn his eyes away as he waited in terror for the pistol shot. Excellent, said Ignatius as he removed the gun from the chairman's head and returned to his seat. Both the bankers were still trembling and quite unable to speak. The minister picked up the battered briefcase by the side of his chair and placed it on the glass table. He pressed back the clasps and the lid flicked up. The two bankers stared down at the neatly packed rows of $100 bills. Every inch of the briefcase had been taken up. The chairman quickly estimated that it probably amounted to around $5 million. "I wonder, sir," said Ignatius, "how I go about opening an account with your bank." And that story was written by Geoffrey Archer, comes from a book called A Twist in the Tale, published in 1988.
Thank you, Anne. The Americans by Barry Lee Thompson of Elwood Writers was first broadcast on Cover to Cover in October 2020. Here it is again with a new introduction by Barry. The Americans, the fourth story in Broken Rules and Other Stories, is an homage to the annual summer holidays I used to take with my parents when I was growing up. We would spend 2 weeks every year in a seaside location, usually in the UK. For many years, Bournemouth, on the south coast of England, was our destination, although we visited the Channel Islands, Willacombe, Torquay, and the Isle of Wight. These getaways were magical. This was a world of guest houses, B&Bs, half-board accommodation, mystery coach tours, cricket on the beach, and sandwiches and fresh cream meringues with a flask of tea in our rented beach hut. A few times we stayed in a guest house in Sandown on the Isle of Wight, and it's this guest house that I used for the Americans, though I changed its location to Bournemouth. I added both the routines and the possibilities within our holidays. You never knew who you might meet or what might happen. Smells played a large part, even well before the holidays had started, with the scent of the brochures that my parents brought back from the travel agents at the start of the year. On holiday, the aroma of frying bacon and eggs wafting up the stairs meant another exciting day was beginning. The smell of suntan lotion, not sunscreen, too. I'd start the fortnight using a fairly high SPF, though not so high as to impede the tanning process. Then I'd drop to a lower number when my tan had progressed. The tanned skin provided, I believed, an element of natural protection. It was all about the tan rather than protection from the sun. Back at the guest house, the smell of soup signalled the start of the dinner service. Descending to the dining room, there'd be a tantalising melange of adult colognes and perfumes and hair lacquer. And then, after dark, a soothing, perfumed after-sun lotion was applied to hot and peeling skin at bedtime. One evening during one of our fortnights on the Isle of Wight, I'd gone upstairs towards my room, and one of two brothers staying with their parents came out of their room and took a pee on the landing right in front of me and right into the middle of the carpet. I think the boy must have been sleepwalking because he didn't register my presence at all. I might as well have been one of the shadows on the landing. I wasn't sure what to do. I didn't want to mention the incident to anyone because I didn't want to get the boy into trouble. I hurried to my own room as if by leaving the scene I might erase my presence or my witness. The next day, the landing was as if nothing had happened. The carpet appeared to have been forensically cleaned up, and the only scents were of laundered linen and guest soaps. I revisited this episode for a scene near the end of the story, but with different actors and entirely different circumstances. The first person narrator in The Americans may or may not be similar to me. It's not for me to say. I think elements of the narrator's character are similar to mine. I can certainly relate to many of the experiences he describes. Like him, I was an adventurer on childhood holidays, relishing opportunities to encounter the wider world, to interact with difference, and to learn and grow from this. And maybe I'm also as likely to find some commonality with the narrator's father or with his mother. I looked up the Sandown guest house online recently and was sad to see that it's closed down now. On the street view of the Maps app, the building, though smaller than I recall, is comfortingly familiar and rich with memories. I can easily lose myself in this nostalgia. Rabbit holes are everywhere these days. Right at the last minute, before signing off on the final version of Broken Rules and other stories, I decided to fictionalise the name of the guest house in The Americans, and it became the Avonham, after a park in Preston, Lancashire. I kept the real names of proprietors, though. I wonder what Dave and Rose are doing now. The Americans by Barry Lee Thompson, from his collection Broken Rules and Other Stories, published by Transit Lounge in 2020. To my mother, they were simply the Americans. At breakfast, in the bright optimism of the Avonham dining room, she would say in her low, sing-song voice, buttering toast, head cocked to the side, not looking at anyone in particular, "Here come the Americans." It was said in a way that suggested we might consider making some adjustments to our behaviour. Her expression would morph into carefully studied nonchalance. This would prompt me to sit up straighter in my chair, while my father, in his usual unflappable manner, didn't react at all. My parents and I were always downstairs in the dining room before the Americans arrived. But I had a wish that one day we might arrive at the same time as the other family, so we could have longer in their company and be more at leisure to absorb their American ways. I enjoyed observing them, the way they handled their cutlery, how they chewed their food, how they spoke to one another. They'd still be breakfasting as we were leaving to go back to our rooms to gather our belongings for a day at the beach. There was always the opportunity of dinner, but coming near the end of the day, this event held less potential for a hatching of shared plans. I felt that if we were to spend more time together in the early bacon and eggs atmosphere, there would be a chance for the parents to suggest getting together at the beach later on for milkshakes and meringues and games of cricket. They were a family of four, each of them fascinating to me in their own right. But it was the boy who especially captured my interest. He was unlike any of the boys I knew back at home. Almost as tall as his father, he moved through space with a steady athletic grace, as if he were moving through water. I'd never visited his country, a place of skyscraping buildings and grand, monstrous bridges and graffiti-plastered alleyways and subway trains. I knew only from the late-night police dramas on the television. It was as if this boy had jumped straight out of the streets of San Francisco or New York into the quaint seaside lanes of the south coast of England. He had a look of not caring much for anything. His sister appeared to possess a similar outlook. They shared a peculiar facial expression, like grazing cows with no particular reach in life beyond the perimeter of their paddock. Nothing caused them to smile or betray any flickers of curiosity. I hardly ever noticed the girl looking at me. At times, I wondered if she were even aware of my existence. The morning the American family walked into the dining room for the first time, the air inside the guest house was shifted. Even before I'd heard any of them speak, I could see they had an otherness about them. They smelled of different laundry products, for one thing. They moved in an alien way, confident, expansive, territorial. Dave, the man who ran the Avonham with his wife, greeted the family and showed them to the table next to ours. He made a showy fuss of pulling out the daughter's chair and shaking out her napkin and placing it across her knees. She accepted his attention without a hint of acknowledgement. "Good morning," my mother trilled to the American woman. "Good morning," said the other mother, smiling like none of my mother's friends at home ever smiled. The woman spoke the way a character in a television show might speak. I doubt my mother knew straight away that the woman was American. She would have just detected a hint of something foreign, a not-one-of-us aspect to the woman. I was in two minds about their close proximity. On the one hand, I wanted the family near to us so I could observe them freely and without any obstructions. But I also knew that having them so close would inevitably consume my energies and distract me to exhaustion. And it opened up the possibility I might be embarrassed at some inopportune disclosure from my mother about my lack of interest in sports or my solitary nature or my liking for quiet, gentle pursuits. My feeble 13-year-old physique always up for scrutiny, and I didn't want to be compared unfavourably to the alarming, robust health of the American boy. My mother didn't like the American woman. I could tell from the way her face twitched, invisible to untrained eyes, but to me and my father it was as clear as if she'd declared her feelings to everybody in the dining room. My mother developed quick, instinctive opinions about people, and once formed, they rarely changed, even in the light of overwhelming new evidence to the contrary. Other people occupied her thoughts more than anything else. Though she deplored this trait in others, she was what might have been called a busybody, nosy. I used to dread the idea that I might inherit this unhealthy obsession. While all around us, people were busily going about their daily lives, my mother was busily observing them. It never occurred to me that my own family might have been material for somebody else's gossip, or that my mother would one day magically emerge to me as someone I would like to have the opportunity of meeting again. My father was fastidiously deconstructing a boiled egg, and he raised his eyes to mine, and I knew he was thinking the same thing. We both knew that my mother thought this other woman too much, with her loud smiles and her unrestrained arrival into the dining room, and the way she did this with her hair and that with her jewellery. It would all become explicit later that morning, when we were away from the guest house. Rarely did anyone come up to my mother's standards. People were too forward, or too reticent, too mousy, or too showy, too familiar, or too standoffish. And the clincher, when nothing else was available to her, was that they were just too much. At this, my father would say nothing, sometimes looking to me as if I might have an appropriate rejoinder. We both quietly knew it was my mother who was too much, but we'd never have dared to voice this, not even to each other. Now at breakfast, my father was chiming in with a cheery good morning. Then the other father came in too, so that all the adults were greeting like bells in a tower over the scraping of chairs and clattering of hard smiles. I watched the American boy carefully throughout the exchange. He didn't look at any of the adults. At one point he nudged his sister and then described a shape or a symbol on the tablecloth with his index finger. As she watched his hand, he looked sideways at her and something passed over their faces. Not a smile, more an effort not to smile. The boy caught my gaze and I couldn't quite read his expression. I hadn't seen it before on anybody else's face and so wasn't able to interpret it. I still find it hard to recall the look at Will, but I've seen it since. It was a knowing look, as if he were aware of what I was after, even though I didn't yet know it myself. His look filled me with a mysterious, tingling hope. When the family's breakfast was well underway, he stood and went to the juice table. It was a rickety thing with a white cloth covering two plain glass jugs of apple and orange juice and a tray of overturned glasses. He helped himself to the orange juice and drank more than half the glass while he was standing there. He topped up his glass and put the jug, now almost empty, back onto the table. He stood at the table, sipping, hand upon his hip. The chalky seaside landscape that hung over the table had caught his eye, and he took in the cliffs, the sea, the amateurish attempts to capture the dramatic play of light and colours and fix an impression of them onto the canvas. The banality of that painting was familiar to me, and I wondered what he saw in it. I looked closely. He was slim, but not skinny like me. His hair and skin were the colours of a baked cheesecake. His jeans were faded to cornflower blue and snug, despite his slim frame. I imagined all that his jeans were pretending to hide. But more than this, I wanted to ask him about his jeans. I wanted to know where such jeans could be found. Had he chosen them himself? I wanted to find out what he felt and thought about when he chose to wear them. His hairstyle was a long way from my short and neat schoolboy crop. My hair was nothing special and didn't invite attention, except once in a public toilet from a man who asked if I would like to borrow his comb when he saw me drying my hands through my hair. I told him no, in keeping with advice from my father. My hair was dull, but the American boy's hair cascaded lustrously to his shoulders. He had a habit of moving it away from his eyes with his fingertips, sweeping it back and then down to the sides behind his ears. He was doing this now as I watched him, and I realized He was looking at himself in the glass of the picture. I wondered why he didn't just get his hair cut, as it appeared to cause him so much trouble. I would pluck up the courage and ask him about this, too, I decided. Here was a person I wanted to befriend. An opportunity was bound to present itself. Maybe we would find the chance to go and have an ice cream or a milkshake together. Just the two of us. Dave came out from the kitchen, smiling at the assembled guests. He noticed the almost empty orange juice jug and picked it up and looked at it as if he'd never seen it before. Then he took it away back into the kitchen, and it didn't return to the table that morning, as far as I knew. Over the next few days, it was the mystery of the boy's voice that came to interest me more than anything else. I couldn't imagine him speaking. I wanted to experience his sound, his American accent, to watch his lips form coherent words and utterances. The thought of talking directly with him gave me butterflies, but still, I wanted to hear him, to know what he had to say. I longed to spend time in his company. But he occupied a very quiet space. It was frustrating. At some point, he would have to say something, anything, if only to communicate what he wanted for breakfast or for pudding after dinner. But he didn't. Or I didn't hear him. One morning, his mother brushed a strand of hair from his temple and asked him if he would like some eggs. He nodded and made a noise like an affirmation, and then he looked up to see me staring at him. I didn't care that he saw me looking, because it was the only piece of action taking place, so I had every reason to be watching. And so I felt the creep of bravery. We stared at each other, but he had added strength from the presence of his mother, so that my courage left me, and I couldn't hold it any longer, and I had to look away. Whenever his mouth moved in speech, his mother leaned in to him and put her head near to his lips to catch his utterances. Occasionally, she hugged him close and long and placed a tender kiss onto his cheek, and a part of her lips brushed his. I looked at my own mother to see if she'd noticed this. I didn't want her getting any ideas. But she was buttering a slice of toast. She was always buttering a slice of toast. Her body was inclined faintly towards the other table, so attuned was she to the activities there. Even though she seemed otherwise absorbed, she wasn't missing a thing. I had an idea that she might be using the wide butter knife as a mirror, watching everything reflected on its shiny metal surface. The boy looked older than me. This was confirmed one morning in our room when my mother remarked to my father that the American boy was well developed for his age. I was tallish but very skinny, lanky, gangly, awkward, whereas he was built like a young man. "He's only 14," she said to my father. Then she turned to appraise me with a pout. "He'd make two of you," she said, down her nose, frowning, and I felt a sharp, draining rush of failure, but also sheer embarrassment at this attention drawn to my physicality and its impending changes. A lot can happen to a teenager in a year. Who knew what it looked like when I got to his age? But I didn't want to discuss any of this. I preferred to keep my body and its development firmly outside the realms of family discussion. Although it never became clear to me why they were holidaying in Bournemouth, we came to learn a number of facts about the American family. My mother had a technique for garnering information. From tidbits overheard at the dining table, she could construct complete histories. Nothing got past her. She could have worked effectively in the intelligence services. It turned out the family was from Boston. Boston! The very name was so American, I found it utterly incomprehensible that a family from Boston should want to take its annual holidays in Bournemouth. Surely Boston was a holiday destination in itself. "Where is Boston exactly?" I asked my father one morning. We were waiting in the lobby for my mother to come down from getting ready in the bedroom. We'd just seen the Americans leave the dining room and make their fragrant way upstairs. Dave's wife, Rose, was at the front desk, arranging pamphlets on local attractions into a plastic display case. "East Coast," my father said, low and muttered in a way that told me he wasn't quite sure. "Why are they here?" I said. "They're on vacation," he said, in a corny American accent. Then he looked around him. "On vacation," he said again, in a higher voice. this time without the accent. "But why here?" I said. "Why not?" he said. "Bournemouth is as good as anywhere. Don't you like it here?" I did like Bournemouth, in many ways, and each year I looked forward with great eagerness to our fortnight away. In fact, I spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about the holidays during the rest of the year. But Bournemouth wasn't Boston. It was no America. And I would have been mortally disappointed to learn that it lay at the limit of life's adventures. I didn't want to hurt his feelings, though, so I just said yes, and then, when he appeared satisfied, I added, "That's a strange place for Americans to visit." "A strange place for Americans," he said. "For a family like that," I said, and I hoped he would understand what I meant, because I wasn't really sure myself. He looked at me as if I had said something awkward or difficult, and then, just when he appeared to be about to offer an observation, he glanced over my shoulder. "Here comes your mother," he said, and so I turned, and there she was, floating down the stairs as though she were entering an imperial ballroom. We were in the town centre, taking advantage of the late-night shopping, searching for holiday souvenirs to take back to family, friends, colleagues of my father, the neighbours at home. My mother had a scrupulously compiled list of gift recipients. My father suggested that once the shopping was finished, we might round off the evening with a twilight stroll through the botanic gardens before the gates were locked for the night. Our holiday was beginning to draw to a close, the yearly fortnight away soon to be reduced to diminishing tan lines and a folder of smiling photos. During our stroll, I spied the American family ahead of us. This was the first time I'd seen them away from the guest house, and I was pleased to know they occupied themselves with similar things to us in the evenings. They were milling around near a fountain festooned with garlands of multicoloured lights. I had no doubt my mother's sensors had alerted her to this development. We slowed our pace, behaving as a unit, taking the lead from my mother's stealth. She wouldn't want to catch up to the family, and I was quite sure she would prefer to avoid any interactions at all in these public surroundings. Suddenly, the American boy put his hand in the fountain and splashed his sister with a precisely distant scoop of water. She yelped, then shouted something, and the two of them started running around like a couple of small children. My mother had stopped us at a kiosk to look at souvenirs and sweets and postcards while all of this was going on nearby. I took up a clever position at a dusty wire rack displaying the usual postcards of the town and the beach and nearby attractions shown by day and night. I was able to watch the boy closely as he ran about. I enjoyed this glimpse of him engaged in physical activity. I occasionally lifted and fingered a postcard to add the impression of absorption in the images, though I could have been holding a photograph of a Parisian street scene for all I knew or cared. I tried to capture the shape of his voice as he called out to his sister, but the sounds were distorted by distance and air and the rush and gurgle of the water from the fountain. The mother joined in with the horseplay, chasing her teenagers around the fountain, but the daughter slowed and then stopped and dropped out of the game, so that it was just the boy and his mother running round and round. He chased the mother one way, then swapped so the chaser became the hunted. The father and the girl stood next to each other, looking as though they had given up. "I still think he's adopted," my mother said, holding up a pointless glass ornament filled with layers of swirling coloured sand. I don't think she was at all aware of what she was holding, although she squinted into it in the way a collector of antiques might. "I've told you what I think. It's none of our business," my father said. He shoved his hands deep into his pockets and was dawdling aimlessly around the edges of a table stacked high with gaudily wrapped boxes of toffees and fudge, all ribbons and cellophane, and depictions of lurid seaside scenes. His response quieted her briefly, and she considered the ornament, turning and twisting it in her fingers. I tried to picture her chasing me in these gardens, round the fountain, one way then the other, splashing and laughing. But the image wouldn't come. It was impossible to imagine my mother high or carefree or reckless in blue jeans. The next night, the Americans didn't appear at dinner,
and my mother kept going on about how they would miss it altogether if they didn't hurry. "Maybe they've gone out to eat," my father said, gnawing at the stubborn meat on the bone of a lamb chop. "Don't you sometimes feel like trying something different?" "But they've paid for dinner here," said my mother, being an all-inclusive type. My father dropped the bone onto his plate, and it made a hollow clatter. Dessert arrived. I was having ice cream with chopped nuts and chocolate syrup. My parents had asked for the cheese board. On this trip, my father had developed a liking for an unusual Danish cheese, striated with blue veins, and now he was arranging some of this onto a cream cracker. My mother glowered as if he were enjoying the cheese out of a desire to be contrary. Just then, the American family burst into the dining room. The sun wasn't with them. It was just short of 8 o'clock, and by this time, the dinner performance was usually over. My mother picked up the salt cellar, inclined it towards the ceiling lights, and gazed into it, rolling it around in her fingers as if seeking a fortune inside the grains. "Are we too late?" the mother crooned to Dave. "Of course not," said Dave, unconvincingly, wringing his hands and shooting an anxious glance along the corridor to the kitchen. My mother had said that the chef liked a drink, and I wondered if this had something to do with Dave's uncertainty. He guided them to their usual table. Without moving her head, my mother slid her sleeve up her wrist to consult her watch. She glanced at my father, her left eyebrow raised. She clearly wouldn't have shown the family the same grace. "Terrific," said the mother. "We had a slight delay at the beach." "Oh," said Dave, looking pained and somehow responsible for events at the beach. "I do hope everything's all right," he said, terribly proper and English all of a sudden. The woman became more American in response. "Nothing to worry about," she said brightly. "Teenagers, you know how it is." Dave didn't pursue it, and I wondered if he did know how it was, or if he might ask Rose about it later that night. He pulled out the mother's chair. The boy's chair remained disappointingly empty. I'd almost finished my ice cream, and the cheese board looked done with, so shortly we'd be off for our nightly walk, and then I wouldn't see him again until breakfast. We were nearing the end of our holidays, and I still believed that he and I were destined to come together in some way, even if only to share a milkshake. This predestiny would have to unfold soon, otherwise I'd be going back up north on the train, and he'd be flying home to Boston, and we'd never see each other again. Dave rushed around to the daughter's chair, but she sat down too quickly for him to pull it out for her. He shook out her napkin from the table and draped it over her lap, adjusting it with care. She said something from between her teeth. I eyed the girl intently, trying to join her dots. I pictured her cruising the streets of Boston in her boyfriend's big red car, driving with one hand on the wheel, the other on the gear stick. The boyfriend suggests they stop at Misty's for burgers and soda, and you can tell me all about your vacation in England. She rolls her big cow eyes and tells him that holidays were boring and England's so dull, 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 dull. She blows a huge bubble of pink gum, then pops it with a perfectly painted hot pink fingernail, then says she'd much rather hear what he's been up to over the summer. And then, as I realized that I too would rather hear what he's been up to over the summer, the images from Boston dissolved to leave just the girl glaring at me. I tried to offer an uncertain smile, but she was having none of it. "I'll bring you the soup," said Dave to the mother. "Will your son be joining us?" "He's getting changed," she said, glancing at her husband again. "Oh," said Dave. He eyed the wall clock, which had edged beyond the sacred hour of 8. He went back to the kitchen. The American woman said, "Soup again," in a distracted voice, to no one in particular, as she moved her cutlery into a more satisfying arrangement. "I hope everything is okay," the mother said. She was looking from beneath those formidable eyebrows, still holding on to the salt cellar. The woman, caught masterfully off guard, said, "Graham made some new friends down at the beach. He lost track of time. We had to hurry to get back." She looked at her husband, and I briefly thought that he might be the Graham she talked of. Oh, said my mother. He went off for a while, that's all. It's not like him. We were concerned. Apparently, I should learn to let go. She looked at her husband again. Realization set in, and I felt a pang of disappointment that her son had been making new friends at the beach, when all the time I'd been on the same beach, available, and only too willing to hang out with him. Here comes Graham now, said the woman. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to shower before dinner. Her voice trailed off, and she looked down at the splayed fingers of her hand as though checking the nails were clean. The American boy entered the dining room. Graham! What a wonderful name! My mind was flooded with a striking image of him taking the shower he didn't have time for. Concerned at where this might take me, and knowing I would soon have to stand up and leave the dining room, I tried to banish the thought by watching my father chase errant crumbs of cheese and cracker with his fingertip. Yes, said my mother, drawing out the word as though everything had been explained. She watched Graham as he pulled out his chair. I wondered if she also had in her head an image of him standing beneath jets of water, soap suds running down his bare chest and long, slim legs. All this adult attention, had I been its recipient, would have made me blush. I examined Graham's face, grateful that he was the centre of activity, that it was okay for me to stare. Permission to gaze is a wonderful thing. Sparse whiskers were straggling at the edge of his cheeks. His hair, tangled and matted with salt and sand, stuck out at the back and sides. It all seemed so carefree and bronzed and Californian. When he was seated, his mother said it was good of him to join them. Honey, said their father sharply. Then he whispered a softer honey, but the echo of the first stayed in the air. He said something quietly about boys and wild oats. He was looking at my father, which seemed odd, but nobody reacted. At the mention of wild oats, Graham caught my eye. I wanted to smile, to rescue things for him, to demonstrate an allegiance. But I felt stung and sore, and it wouldn't come. He hesitated. Just a brief pause, a hiccup in his insouciance. Then he turned away and looked down, and I noticed then that he actually was blushing. That night after dinner, the American parents were in the bar, as well as my parents, and a loose collection of background guests I'd largely forgotten about. The American teenagers had gone elsewhere to places I could only imagine. Their parents were seated on stools at the bar the way Americans sit in the movies. We were at our usual table near the door. I couldn't picture my mother up on a bar stool. I don't think she'd have known where to put her handbag. The Americans were talking to Dave while he stocked the fridge with bottles. I won't be coming back next year, said my mother. We're not the only guests, said my father. It's just his way of getting to know them. It's their first time. He's putting them at ease. He palpated his tie knot and centered it just so, and then, satisfied, sipped from his glass of beer. Ease my foot, she said. Dave held up a bottle of wine, displaying the label. The woman read it. Dave made some comments. Then she laughed loudly, head back like a seal catching fish. Her husband's shoulders remained steady and square, and he had the guarded air of a stranger who happened to be sitting next to her. I said that I wanted to go upstairs to read. My father handed over the room key. I'll bring you a drink later, and a snack, if you're still awake, he said. So off I went with a vague idea to have one of my rambling nighttime adventures. But I didn't go outside this time. Instead, sure that the adventure resided within the hotel, I started to walk upstairs. I arrived at the first floor, and Graham came running up the stairs behind me. I said a weak hi as he passed, and at first I thought I'd been too quiet for him to hear, but then he turned around and smiled, and something in the middle of my chest dropped out of my body. He unlocked and went into a room on that floor, number 12. He left a trace of the cool evening in his wake. After he closed the door behind him, it held some element of him, resounded with clues upon and beyond its plain white surface. I stood on the landing for some time. The light, tinged green from the carpet, had an underwater quality, and there was a reassuring smell of laundered linen and cakes of perfumed toilet soap. It was conceivable that if I was still and quiet, no one would ever come by, and nothing would happen for the remainder of my life. I could cheat the rules of space and time and prevent the world from moving forward. As a watched kettle never boils, or a corded phone never rings, so a watched door will not open. A watched staircase produces no movement. It was a beautiful superstition, with Graham's nearness to me fixed for eternity. But I broke the spell. I took a tentative step towards room 12. If I knocked on the door, if Graham were to answer, I'd say, "What? What could I say?" The answer would, I was certain, come to me. I'd be rescued by fate. I had nothing to lose, and everything to lose. The holiday was almost over. I drew a fortifying breath, readying myself for the anxious unknown. But, my heart was fluttery. I felt far away, a faint impression removed from myself and the scene. I heard a noise behind me from the stairs, like fabric swishing through air, so I moved away from the door, retreating silently into a shady recess near the top of the stairs. The American woman passed by in a perfume of alcohol and fresh cigarette smoke. She stood outside room 12 and straightened her skirt, then knocked on the door. Nothing happened at first, but she was patient and didn't bother knocking again. Eventually, the door opened. She said something. A radio's faint music came from inside the room. Then Graham stepped forward, appearing in the doorway. He was shirtless, and a white guest towel was secured tight around his hips, so low as to reveal the line of the top of his pubic hair. There were drops of water on his chest. His hair was black with wetness and slicked away from his face. His mother was talking, but I couldn't make out what was being said. He looked alternately from her face to the carpet at his feet. He kept fiddling with a tendril of his damp hair, playing it away as it tumbled over his face. As he lifted his arm to do this, there was a flash of dark hair in his armpit. Bushy, manly, raw, and exciting. A public display of his body's changes. I wondered when, if ever, hair would begin to grow under my arms. She reached out, as if she were about to take his hand, but instead she put two fingers inside the top of the towel and pulled him towards her. She kissed him on the cheek, near to his ear, the way I'd seen her do in the dining room. They came apart, then kissed again. He stepped back into the doorway and said something. He looked down. She placed her hand upon his upper arm, and he looked up. He said something that sounded like, "Soldiers." Then she nodded, then walked away, and he closed the door. She saw me standing there, but didn't speak or register any surprise. She bumped into the banister and went down the stairs, back to the bar, into the activity. It was now just me and Graham on opposite sides of a closed door. Watching all of this had loosened something inside me. My mother had a concern, often voiced to her friends, to neighbours, teachers, to anyone prepared to listen, that I wasn't a mixer, that I didn't take part in things and had no interest in socialising with other children my age. She talked it up into a problem. She was right in her categorisation, but wrong in her attitude. I had chosen to be that way. I had limited interest in the company of other children. But I recognised that here was a chance to put that right, to make an effort to get myself out there and reach towards a boy of my age, or near to my age. Hands across the water, a friendship for life, perhaps. I walked up to his door. "Tell me about America," I thought. That's all I had to say. "Tell me about Boston. I want to hear all about the streets of your city, its smells, sounds, its people, your friends. Tell me what they look like. Tell me all about your friends and what you talk of with them, and describe the things you think of when you turn the lights out at night." And so, with this in mind, I tapped on the door three times, almost as if I didn't want anyone to answer, but each knock was slightly louder than the last. Because in truth, I did want someone to answer, even though I knew that the easiest and least challenging outcome would have been for no one to respond. There was no answer, so I tried again, three knocks, slightly louder this time. In the middle of the door was a tiny peephole, like a bubble, and I fancied that he might be looking through it, spying the distortion of my face, trying to figure it out, and thinking that perhaps whoever it was had come to the wrong room. My inquiry wasn't answered. I counted down from 10 while I was standing there, believing he might come to the door before I got to 1. Then I counted down again, slowly, slowly, certain that something had to happen after a countdown. Something must happen. Life depended on events occurring. I considered knocking again, just one more time. I think about it sometimes, and I wonder what might have been had I tried that third time. The Americans by Barry Lee Thompson from his collection Broken Rules and Other Stories, published by Transit Lounge in 2020. It was after this program was prepared that we heard of the death of Jenny Bryce, a founding member of Elwood Writers. The other Elwood Writers and I will be working on a tribute program to Jenny to be broadcast in coming weeks. My thanks to Anne Brett for her contributions for this program. Join me again next week for Cover to Cover when I read Gold Rings by Stuart McBride and Barry Leveny reads The Three-Legged Bitch by Alan Marshall. I'm Tim McQueen. Until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this Vision Australia Radio podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Visit varadio.org for more.
Vision Australia Radio.
Blindness. Low vision.
Opportunity.